What? We're back again. Volume 4. This train ain't stopping. Flying solo, Chris is in Europe. He emailed me this morning. All that was contained in the email was a picture of Chi-Chi's in Belgium. It exists! We, the Americans, may have had enough of that place, but Belgium, they're all over Chi-Chi's. They can't get enough. So it sounds as if he is spending his time in Europe intelligently. I'm left at home. Oh my God, people. This is Totally Tanner. We just dig into my life, the mundane, the magnificent. If you could even call anything that's ever happened in my life magnificent, that is highly debatable. But wow, a lot going on in my life recently. I'll tease you to begin with. I think I almost died twice last week alone. We'll get into that. But one thing that's been on my mind recently, after work, if you don't know, in San Francisco, in the tech world, we have these things called shuttle buses that basically serve as mass transit for ultra advantaged tech types. They allow people who work at startups and the like to never have to see a brown person ever and just go from work onto their shuttle bus. Aw, man. Directly home or onto the BART and shoot off into, or the Caltrain and shoot off into wherever they end up living. Their $2,000 a month studio apartment. That's on the low end, people. Anyway, we have these shuttle buses. In my work, because I work in a building with a very notable large startup, they fund these shuttle buses for us. I work at a nonprofit. We don't have this kind of cash, but I can hop on these buses nevertheless. And I do occasionally take the bus to the BART. I was on this bus recently, and a coworker of mine was in the seat in front of me. She's our HR person, and I'm guessing in her mid-40s, mid to late 40s. Your typical middle-aged white woman, you know, very nondescript, very inoffensive. Seems to be a nice woman. I don't really know her all that well. Don't have much interaction with her. But seems very, very standard. Like, you could go into a dress barn at any strip mall in the world and see a million of this person there. She was in the seat in front of me, and I could see through the seat what she was doing on her phone. And this is one of my favorite pastimes on public transit. One of the best things about public transit is just watching what the fuck people are up to on their phones, tablets, or whatever. Reminds me of this picture I saw of this guy, this Japanese dude on the metro in Tokyo. And he's sitting there, and perspective of the photograph is we're dead on looking at him face to face. He's seated on the subway with his tablet up in front of his face with a very stern, serious look, you know, and he's got headphones on. He's looking at something very intently, like he's reading The Atlantic or something. But then reflected in the window behind him, you can see what's on his tablet. It's It's a very buxom anime girl with her boobs on full display. I haven't yet caught anything like that, although I did see a guy Oh my god, I forgot about this. Okay, I did see something. I saw a guy browsing what looked to be a dating server. I think it was Plenty of Fish, and he's on his phone shuffling through pics, and this woman, this very heavy set black woman, in her pics, she is in the most ridiculously risque postures you can imagine, much like an anime pinup. But he's just there on a very, very full train, rifling through those photos. I think it's like in the car when people pick their nose and they feel like they're in this shield. That kind of happens on public transit as well. You definitely have more of a presence of being watched, but I think people, when they get really sucked into their phones, they don't realize that everyone's looking. So I'm on this shuttle bus. I'm watching my HR person on her phone, and she's looking through her contacts and her messages, as people do. You know, and there's Diane and Susan and Bev and whoever the fuck on her phone. And then she's scrolling, and then pauses on a person and clicks into the conversation. That would be strange, but this person's name on her contacts, remember, this is the dress barn lady, this person's name on the contacts was Ice. And not only Ice, but it was in all caps. ICE, all capital letters on this woman's phone. She clicks through and begins to talk to this person on the message. And I'm like, oh, my mind starts racing. I'm like, who in the fuck is Ice? Who, and what is she talking to Ice about? I can only imagine who Ice is. I mean, the only people named Ice are either hitmen or rappers. There's no, the Venn diagram of people named Ice is fairly limited. And she was just, it appeared, the conversation seemed pretty normal. I couldn't get all the details, but it was just kind of a typical conversation that she was having with Ice. And I'm picturing this guy in Brian Bosworth-esque wraparound sunglasses, spiked hair, a leather jacket with studs on it that you'd either see on Mad Max or a pro wrestler in the 80s. Some loan shark or something sitting in a strip club, some desert in Southern California, and she's sitting there. My HR person's talking to this guy, Ice. It made me start thinking about, I need to rename everyone in my contacts all kinds of bizarre handles, just so by chance someone sees my phone ringing or something and divine justice flashes on the screen, or road pig or something. Oh my god, Ice, if you're out there, let us know.
It was an average night backstage at a show. I seen this girl late that I knew, she was a cutie, and yo, she had it going on from my head to her feet. Her shape was so petite and so unique. Her eyes flamed with passion like she was possessed, as I shivered and quivered while she rubbed on my chest. Slaved and engraved, I couldn't scream. Moaning and groaning like she could take on the A team. I was one of many that she had choose. Do me, pursue me twice as nice, but don't refuse.
So I know you're all dying to hear about how my book selling is going. We talked about that in the last Totally Tanner. I was finally getting to this point where I was giving up my academic dreams, my career dreams to be a professor, and doing that through selling off all of my books. And people, I've got a ton of books. That's going incredibly well. I'm selling so many books, Amazon asked me to fill out a W-9. It was like, what? Suddenly I'm an employee? I'm a contractor of Amazon? Like, what in the hell? But I've sold, I would have to estimate at this point, I've probably sold $400 to $500 of books. I've been at the post office constantly. It seems like every day I'm at the post office, and it feels good. It feels like I'm cleansing myself. It feels like detox or something. I'm finally getting rid of all this stuff that's been weighing me down physically, mentally for so long. I'm finally just discarding it. I feel lighter. I feel like I'm moving on with my life in a productive way, and that's a strange feeling to me. I usually feel like I dwell on the bad stuff, but I think this is a really good thing I've decided to do, and I'm not feeling regret at all. There was a few brief moments where I was thinking, oh, God, I saw a picture of a guy in a magazine, a chef, actually, who lived above his restaurant, and he had all his cookbooks around him and everything, and I was thinking, like, oh, I kind of... Like, his identity is wrapped up in those books. My identity feels wrapped up in these books as well that I'm selling off. But who the fuck cares? Seriously. What does it matter? What does any of this stuff matter? You read it, you're done with it. So I'm getting rid of all this, all these books. Keeping a very, very select few. Spending a lot of time at the post office. And good God, people. My local post office. I know people are prone to hyperbole and exaggeration. I am not one of those people, I don't think. Except when I'm using it for comedic effect. But when I tell you this, believe me, this isn't hyperbole. This is the world's slowest post office that's near me. It is god-awful. The line at this post office is always, no exaggeration, at least 20 to 30 feet long. Today I went there. We were nearly out the door. Like, this was 93 and we were in line for Metallica tickets. You are at the post office. Most people are livid. And I feel so bad for the postal workers there, because everyone in that line is fuming. And it's dead silent in there, and you've got usually one to two postal workers there, which is part of their problem. There's a million staff in the back. They've got one to two people handling this ungodly line, and everyone in that line's gaze is fixed on that one, or those one or two people at that register, and they are just shooting daggers at them for the 30 to 40 minutes you got to wait in these lines. And I'm sitting there and I'm loving it. There's something weird with me where because I grew up with a mother who was one of the world's great impatient people. She was one of those people who would be in that line just... She could not remove her gaze from them. And I fully believe that she thought, through her mental anger and frustration, she could telepathically inflict harm, like mind bullets, at the object of her gaze, like a Medusa. And she would just stare. The worst was at restaurants. If she felt she was smited in any way, she would just follow the waiter or waitress around. And believe me, for someone like me, who I feel like I'm a pretty empathic person, I avoid conflict at all possible costs. This destroyed me as a young child. You'd sit there and you'd watch her inflicting psychic damage like a Sith Lord on a poor minimum wage, just barely scraping by waitress at Big Boys. Anyway, I don't know what I'm saying here. Everyone in line basically is doing this to the postal workers every time I go there. And I just sit there and I've gotten to the point where I love that the postal workers are seemingly impervious to this. I know this is a fiction I'm telling myself where they probably hate their jobs and their lives because they have to, you know, they are subject to this day in and day out. There is no pleasure for them. That line is never getting shorter. They are constantly overburdened and constantly the subject of people's misplaced anger and rage. But in this fiction I've created, these postal workers have all united together and they're like, let's just say fuck it. And they are seemingly impervious. They move in slow motion. They move in a sloth-like manner. And I can say this because I use this post office and the one by my work almost in equal measure. And the one by my work is far smaller, seems to go through the same volume, but at 3 to 4 times the speed. I know because I mail the same amount of books every time, about 5 books, media mail. It takes a third of the time at the post office by my work that it does at this one by my house. And so I'm sitting there, I've created this fiction where I believe the postal workers are just leaning into the hellishness of their lives and putting everyone else through torture like it's some grand life lesson they're imparting on everyone else to be patient and to realize the utter absurdity of getting angry at the post office. And something like this seems all the more relevant in light of, you know, someone like Robin Williams' death or say the awfulness that is going on in Ferguson, Missouri. All these these big things, you know, with Robin Williams passing, it reminds you of your own death and the crippling nature of depression and how success and money and all these things, you know, can be undermined by one's own mind. And with Ferguson, Missouri, you're reminded about how little we've advanced in terms of being equitable and decent to each other and, you know, treating people with respect. And, you know, we're reminded of the brutality of the racist, militarized police state. And meanwhile, within this massive context, people are sitting in line at the post office getting angry that it's taking 10 to 15 minutes too long. And I want to believe that the postal workers are there inflicting that punishment and teaching everyone a lesson like some Buddhist monks or something about the journey and perspective and the absurdity of it all. Which is even more poignant given how long we're all in that damn line. I mean, we're in that line so long. I've seen relationships blossom and crumble. I've seen people get married, divorced, remarried, and then begin to loathe their new wives and husbands and their sexless relationships. I've seen seasons change and presidents get inaugurated and countries splinter off and form new republics, and seen the birth and death of media. I could go on, but I won't. I teased at the beginning that I almost died twice this week. I also said that I don't exaggerate. That was a bit of an exaggeration. I almost died once last week. The second incident, I don't think I was quite near death. Although it would have been a sweet, sweet release. Well, let me get into both those incidents. The first one, where I did almost die, this happened a week ago to the day I'm recording this right now. I had just gone to the post office, in fact. was crossing the street, a street that I cross all the time, routinely. And it's in a relatively busy intersection, but it's a small townish street. It's only maybe four lanes wide. But it's in what's considered a small downtown type area. And it's very pedestrian heavy. But it's also just an area where people aren't all that aware of pedestrians. So I'm crossing the street like I always do. Traffic is stopped. It's a red light. The walk sign is on. And it's pretty busy. This is around lunchtime, so there's cars lined up everywhere at this stop sign. And I'm crossing. One person's crossing with me. I'm going through, and I'm coming up almost to the last lane getting to my destination on the other side of the street. And there's a car just in front of me, and I can't see what's in the other lane beyond that car. But I'm walking, and I walk super, super fast. But I'm confident. I mean, traffic stopped. I just crest this car, crossing through into the final lane of traffic just before I get to the sidewalk. And a car flies past me at, I would say, about 40 miles an hour at full clip, basically. And I'm not kidding you when I felt the rush of air from the car, and it was that close. And if I had taken one more step, I would have been hit by that car. And hit at a really fast speed, I would say. You know, 40 miles an hour is no joke, I don't think. And that person just sailed past and continued on. I barely got a look at it. I did see what kind of car it was because I was a bit in shock, and I looked and looked to the right and saw that it was a brand new Mercedes-Benz, one of the higher class ones, you know, probably a $80,000 to $100,000 car, I think. Saw the person just sail by and continue on, didn't even stop, or I don't even know if this person realized how close they came to hitting me. But I continued on, got to the other side of the sidewalk, and was like, I had to just stand there and process what the hell just happened. Because in my mind, either one of my legs was going to be utterly destroyed, or even I was going to get, you know, spun in such a way that maybe I would have hit my head on the pavement or the car or something and potentially killed or seriously critically injured. There's no question in my mind, if I'd taken one more step, one of those two scenarios would have happened. And I don't know, frankly, that I've ever been in a situation like this. There was one time in high school when a friend was driving me and another friend to school, and we had to leave absurdly early in the morning. It was dark at night. I was getting up at 5:30 in the morning. Probably my friend was as well. We had to be at school at, you know, the bell, first bell rung at 7:20 or some ridiculous time in the morning. So we were always super sleepy driving to school. And I remember this friend was driving us up kind of a country-esque suburban road up towards our school. And I don't remember the exact scenario, but we almost came head on with a semi truck, but my friend swerved out of the way and we made it. I remember us all thinking, holy fuck, that was super close. That's probably the only other time I've had a situation like this happen. I've never been in a car accident. When I was a kid, I did get hit by a scooter, a spree, what we called them sprees. I don't know if other people call them that, but I got hit by one of those and spun around on the ground or whatever, and I just got skidded up. I wasn't in any grave danger there. So this time, I brought me the closest to death or serious injury that I've been in a long time, and I haven't had to process that feeling. But you're in an utter daze with the world, and it seems suddenly everything seems a bit surreal. It's like being on drugs or something. And I just had to stand there for a little while and process it. And I remember looking over to the person who was in the car that I was crossing in front of when I almost got hit. And I looked at this guy. He was a construction worker. I looked at this guy and I mouthed the words, "Holy fuck," to him. And he just stared at me with no feeling whatsoever. Like, not acknowledging anything. And I was looking to him as my anchor. I needed him to be like, "What the fuck was that?" I needed him to recognize how insane and infuriating this moment was. And he just looked at it with this steely, dead gaze, like he was the angel of death or something. And it made the whole situation all the more creepy and perverse. I would imagine if I was sitting in that car and I saw that happen, I would be like, "Oh my God." I would be freaking the fuck out. But that guy was just, and I think this is what car culture engenders in a way. It's this feeling of protection and security and singularity and selfishness that, you know, there's no question this is meshed so well with America and its mythos, and that's why the car has been so critical to this country, because it's the ultimate object of capitalistic frontier bullshit, this feeling of mastery and power in the wilderness and all of this. And I feel like when you're in a car, you get this just numb distance to everything else in the world. And this is one of the reasons why I got rid of my car while living in LA, because I started to see that constantly being in the battle that is commuting via car, you start to feel like you're at war with everything else in the world, and everything else in the world is at war with you. It's like the same mentality that the Bush era and even now Obama era administrations have tried to impart on people around terrorism, that feeling of being under imminent threat, that same kind of feeling you feel when you're in a car. And I started to see it wear on me as a human being. And when I got rid of my car and started taking public transit, I approached the world and other human beings and my own life with so much more love and compassion and interest. And that really, that connected to me in that moment when I was mad at the guy who almost hit me, and then almost even madder at the guy in the car for not giving a shit. And lo and behold, the guy who almost hit me came back around the other way, and I got to see him and his fucking face. And what he was doing was honking at an old woman trying to turn into a laundromat, laying on his horn because she dared to slow down just a little too much as she turned to this laundromat. You know, exactly the kind of person I would have imagined would have blown that red light and almost hit another human being was doing that again. And the fact that he was doing that made me think that he probably didn't even realize he almost hit me, because I feel like he would have self-policed himself a little bit and been like, "Holy shit, maybe I should tone this down." But he then, after doing that to the woman, he pulls up on a side street there and parks and goes into a building. And I got this feeling that I haven't gotten since I was in college or whatever, where I was like, suddenly I was like, oh, fuck, it's on now. I'm going to do something to this guy's car. And I like immediately grab for my keys and I'm looking around for a bottle or something. And I've decided in my mind in a split second, I'm going to fuck this guy's shit up. And meanwhile, I'm a 33, almost 34-year-old professional person. But listen, inside, I'm a raw motherfucker. I want to get down. I want to do some hardcore G shit. So I'm like, I'm doing this thing. This guy needs divine retribution. I need to lay down some street justice on him. And I'm getting up to his car and I'm ready to go. Like my heart's pumping. I'm like, fuck this motherfucker. I'm going to do this. And just as I'm about to do something, and I was probably just going to key the side of his $100,000 Mercedes. Just as I'm about to do something though, a person comes out of the next door business and just plops down on the stoop on that business. It's sitting there right, you know, maybe 15 feet from where I am. And I'm like, fuck. Another time.
Hardcore G shit. Homie, all play around. Ain't shit. Sweet about the peach. This Atlanta clown. Home of the dealers and the strippers in the clubs, though. Catch you coming out that Magic City with a snub, ho. Lurking in the club on tourist motherfuckers. Welcome to Atlanta, up the jury, motherfucker. These monkey niggas looking for some looter in Jermaine. And all that nigga found was some Ruger and some pain. Pow, motherfucker, pow, come up off the chain. Pow, motherfucker, pow, one up in it bright. We some money.
So the second time I almost died just happened. This was Thursday night. Went out, ate some tacos at a local place. Came home, was feeling a little weird. And to give you some backstory on this, I've had some pretty major surgeries on my digestive system. Some serious, serious shit. I'm not talking getting your appendix removed or something. I'm talking straight business kind of surgeries. And so I've got a bunch of scar tissue there. And I'm really sensitive to anything going on in you know, my bowels. And I ate this taco meal. And I started to feel like I was bloating a little bit. I become very attuned to this feeling because what happens is the scar tissue that's built up in my system can sometimes interfere with things getting all the way through it. So something will get stuck. And then at that point, you know, everything just starts getting backed up and backed up and backed up, and you start getting bloated and bloated and bloated. This has happened maybe 4 or 5 times before. Most often, it's just a temporary thing. So I'm thinking, all right, this is probably just a temporary thing. I've had these tacos a million times before. I can't even imagine what could cause this blockage. A few hours are rolling by. Things aren't moving. Feeling worse and worse and worse. And realize this is the real deal. And most, if not all of you, have probably never experienced this. And God, you know, I hope you never have to. It is one of the most awful things. You know, as someone who's dealt with a lot of bullshit related to medical conditions and a lot of horrible, painful things, this is unlike anything else. It is absolutely debilitating awfulness for hours on end. And this was my Thursday night in my Friday morning. This obstruction happens. Suddenly nothing's moving. Meanwhile, your stomach's like, oh God, we got to get stuff through. It's going wild. The nausea is unlike any other nausea I've ever had. I've had food poisoning, stomach flu, all that stuff. This is way, way worse. You can imagine everything that's going down at this point. And probably the worst of it all is you get cramps, you know, a feeling like your stomach is being twisted into knots. So bad that I consider myself a relatively grin and bear it type of person. I'm pretty tough when it comes to dealing with pain because I've had to deal with, you know, a bit in my life. But this knocks me on my ass and I have to sit there like an old man and be like, as I'm dealing with these, what amount to bowel contractions, like I'm ready to birth a baby or something. Awful stuff. The cat is freaked the fuck out. She can't handle it. She knows something is wrong. It's adorable, but awful at the same time, because what is her response to me clutching my stomach and being in the fetal position? Standing on my stomach and scraping at my face. Like, you know, snap out of it, motherfucker. Anyway, I'm telling you this story. Everything's passed. I'm fine now. It took about 3 Vicodin. Finally got to sleep. And, you know, after about 5 to 6 hours of fighting this off, got to sleep for about 2 hours. Was all right the next morning in terms of I was probably at about 60%. Anyway, I'm telling you all this because the craziest part about this whole thing was just as all of this was starting, there was one of the big protests in Ferguson happening. In Ferguson, Missouri, you know, a young man named Michael Brown was murdered by police. The entire town very rightfully is saying, fuck the police, enough of this shit. You know, this is clearly racially motivated and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Total solidarity with those people and the entire movement. And just as all this is starting, I made a tweet about this because, you know, this is race issues are one of my specialties. A lot of people who follow me on Twitter, and believe me, I'm not a big deal on Twitter at all, but a lot of people who follow me on Twitter know that this is kind of my thing. I wanted to make sure to just put it out there that, yo, I'm on board with this. I'm not staying silent because of my job or whatever the hell. You know, solidarity with these people. And I was browsing some news stories and saw this one image that kept being used by all the publications of this one of the protesters tossing this flaming object. And it was being used in a lot of the newspapers as kind of an analog to, you know, the violence and rioting of protest. And look at this person throwing this flaming object in anger and all this. But the story of that picture was actually that was tear gas that these shock troop motherfucking police were shooting at peaceful protesters in what I would say is an unlawful way. And this guy's like, yo, you can take this back. By the way, this guy's holding a bag of Cool Ranch potato chips, which is possibly the coolest thing in this picture. He is throwing that tear gas canister back. It's not a Molotov cocktail or anything. It's this guy saying, fuck this, you could take this back because we're peacefully protesting here. So I tweeted this out with this picture, like, this is circulating. This is not a Molotov cocktail. This is actually a guy throwing tear gas back at cops. And as this sickness sets in, my phone starts buzzing and buzzing and buzzing and buzzing. Beeping, and I'm getting all these emails, and out of nowhere, this little tweet that I sent off that was just a very quick thought. You know, I've been on Twitter since November 2007, it says. I've tweeted 7,000 times. I've got maybe 800 followers. I am the smallest of fries on Twitter. I've seen a million people come onto Twitter since I started and get way, way more popular and successful, and people find way more value in what they say. So I've rarely do I get retweets. And if I do, it's a couple at max in the 7 years I've been on Twitter. God, it's been 7 years. On the 7 years I've been on Twitter, I maybe get 10 retweets max. This tweet I sent out is blowing the fuck up. And I start feeling like, I'm like, this is how Lady Gaga must feel. My feed is getting inundated because I said it because no one gives a shit about anything I say on Twitter. I said it to email me whenever anyone ats me, you know, replies to me, retweets me, or any of this stuff, because it never happens. So sure, I'll get the emails. This tweet suddenly, I'm an internet sensation, people. This tweet, I'm tweet famous from this fucking tweet. This thing exploded. A couple people on my feed retweeted me. People they knew, you know, this is the whole viral nature of this stuff. You know, people start retweeting. You get someone with enough followers and you're in the moment and something can just explode. But having been on Twitter long enough, I know that this is a super rare occurrence. You know, if something explodes, you're looking at 50 to 100 retweets. Ladies and gentlemen, this tweet I sent out, you can look at this if you go to my Twitter feed, and the, you know, friends of the show will know what that Twitter feed is. I don't want to announce it. But this tweet I sent out ended up being one of the biggest tweets and continues to be one of the biggest tweets of this whole, you know, social movement, this whole Ferguson thing, hashtag Ferguson. This tweet I sent out has been retweeted 3,300 times. And it's been favorited 1,800 times. My inbox was out of fucking control. My ads, if you go to my Twitter feed, people have been talking to me. It's been days since I sent out that tweet. They continue to talk to me about this as if I give a shit about what they have to say. I'm Lady Gaga, people. It's the most bizarre thing. I'm involved in conversations. I have no idea who these people are. People are updating me on the status. I'm pretty sure the person in the picture tweeted at me. The photographers tweeted at me. I suddenly became an expert on this. I don't know anything about this event. I just tweeted out a picture with a little line in it, and suddenly I became one of the emblematic what do you call it? Twitter people of this fucking thing. People started getting mad at me, and then people started defending me, and they were getting in conversations all while adding me this whole time. And meanwhile, I've been totally silent. I've blocked a few people who are, you know, clearly dickheads, but I've been trying to be pretty silent on it because I feel really uncomfortable, you know, considering I don't know enough about this or anything. But God, this is what a crazy, insane event that this happened. You know, I'm being facetious here. I'm not a celebrity in any way, but it was such a weird thing to have been on Twitter for 7 years, to be all but ignored entirely, and then just to do something in the midst of this horrible sickness, just off the top of my head, and for that of all things to be possibly my, you know, my identity on Twitter is beyond me. And what is even crazier too is celebrities were retweeting me. The only three I know for sure, and I'm sure there were many more, but so Andrew Zimmerman, the Bizarre Foods guy, retweeted me. Donna Brazile, who is the president of the Democratic National Convention. And it was just fucking insane. And the best, my own personal hero, Paul F. Tompkins, retweeted me, which was, I should have screenshotted. I need to do that. But that was like, holy crap. When I saw I saw in my email, Paul F. Tompkins has retweeted you. I was like, are you kidding me? And when I told Chris this, the first thing he said was, did you do this on the live to tape Twitter? I was like, no, unfortunately not. Very much in line with our strategy of never having any listeners ever. No, I did not take this opportunity to get 3,000 retweets and potentially tens of thousands of eyeballs on my feed. Didn't take that under account. So we'll be back next week with a regular live-to-tape show. Chris will be back from Europe. He can tell us about his travels. Until then, would love it if you could go to iTunes, search us out. You know, if you're a fan of this show or if you're a listener of this show and you like it, helps us out if you find us on iTunes. You click through a little rating there and then just write it just has to be a brief review. Speaking of, I wrote a review for our sister podcast. I think you you have Sister Cities, we have a sister podcast, Extra Secret Podcast. I wrote a review for them, and I don't think iTunes is going to post it. So you know what? I'm going to read that review right now because I know one of the hosts, at least, is listening to this show. This is just an example of the kind of review I'd like you to write us, live-to-tape show listeners. This is my masterclass in review writing. This review clearly is too hot for iTunes. Here we go. Here's the review, the unpublished too hot for iTunes review that I wrote, the Extra Secret Podcast. God done broke the mold when he made the Extra Secret Podcast. Of course, prior to breaking the mold, he had made a nearly unfathomable amount of podcasts about random stuff featuring two white guys. We're talking the kind of number that you've got to sit down with and just think about. The kind of number that makes your mind bend back upon itself. Sort of in that same way your brain hurts when you think about some alien life form that's so bizarre it really redefines what life even means. Something made of translucent material. An alien who communicates through telepathic rhythmic humming and eats quarks or some crap. Anyway, you know that feeling when you think about this life form, this alien, existing on some distant planet, watching whatever that alien's version of Alf is? Well, that's the feeling I get when I think about how many podcasts are out there previous to the Extra Secret Podcast. What I mean is, I know at least 36 white dudes, and they all either number one podcast or number two brew their own beer. So that means almost everybody, white dude or not, has had, currently has, or will have a podcast. But, and this really is the point here, those people that will have podcasts, well, they got to find a new template. Because when God, who, by the way, I'd really like to know your thoughts on, because I'd really like to meet her, done made this show, the Extra Secret Podcast, he done broke the mold because he done decided that he was done with cool podcasts because this one done did that damn thing. That's, for whatever reason, iTunes found that unfit for their website. Anyway, Live to Tape Show at Twitter. Email us live to tape show at gmail.com. We will see you next week.